Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. Today's show is sponsored by our friends at Chase Sapphire Preferred. Thank you, guys. We got an LA 1-2 punch today. First up, Jessica Kozlow, chef of Squirrel Restaurant in Los Angeles. Can I say it's the coolest restaurant in LA, Belle? Can I say that? Producer Belle Cushion just gave me the nod. She did. I can say that. Coolest restaurant in Los Angeles, Squirrel. I do really think some of the most innovative food going on, mostly vegetable-ish, but not vegetarian. And Jessica's hugely influential, and Matt Ducker from Epicurious, sat down with her and asked her all sorts of questions about how she does what she does and the cookbook she's got coming up. And also she'll be at Feast Portland, a food festival we partner with in Portland, Oregon, September 15th through 18th. I don't know. I kind of really do think it is the coolest food festival going on right now. You should check it out at feastportland.com. And Jessica will be there cooking in the Brunch Village event. But that's not all. We also have on today's show Marissa A. Ross, wine columnist for Bon Appetit. And we met up with her in Las Vegas a little while back, Andrew Knowlton and I, during our Vegas Uncorked Food Festival, and we talked all things summer wine with Marissa. So let's get started. Here's Matt Ducker and I talking to Jessica Kozlow. All right, Jessica Kozlow, and first time, Matt Ducker from Epicurious.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me.
And do you know why Matt Ducker's here, Jessica?
I have a feeling I do, because he wrote the Squirrel Power article in Bon Appetit.
He did.
And that launched us into some sort of...
I don't know about that, but...
It's true. You are the reason.
Was that 2 years ago?
This was June 2014 issue.
Wow, man.
We're coming up on a two-year anniversary.
You and I.
Yes.
Yeah. But full disclosure, I called in Ducker for sort of reinforcements because I've never been to Squirrel.
Wow.
I'm like the only person in the food industry, in the food world, who has not been to Squirrel.
Okay, I think we should change that. But I'm elated because I think that we've evolved and we've gotten better and more interesting, and we're doing more interesting things. So it's actually exciting because now you get to experience, like, you know, tough kid.
Confidence squirrel.
Yeah, confidence squirrel versus, like, will you like me, squirrel? You know?
But Matt was pointing out, which was interesting, was that, speaking of your sort of evolution and maturity as a restaurant, that, you know, you guys didn't even start as a restaurant. It was kind of jams, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we started as a jam company. But I think the thing to think about is, you know, when you look at many restaurants, they have a lot of investment behind them. And I started and continue to do Squirrel as myself, as the sole investor. So whatever money I had is what I had to work with. So we started out with the jam because I could afford myself and one employee in a space that I didn't need people to come into.
And you guys are in Silver Lake,
mm-hmm.
correct? I want to make sure I get, what neighborhood do we call it?
We'd have to call it East Hollywood.
Oh, okay. Ducker?
Yeah. What?
Ducker, you're an LA guy.
That's what? East Hollywood? Is that what you call where Squirrel is? Really?
Yeah, it's the one block south of Silver Lake.
Wow.
If but you walk
no
up the hill.
No one calls it East Hollywood.
No one does. But, cool. You know, to be politically correct.
It lives the Silver Lake lifestyle.
We are nothing if not politically correct on this
podcast. All right, yeah. So when you first opened, when you started doing jam, what was your monthly rent at that point?
So I feel very fortunate because my landlords are...
They love jam and they're just like, well,
no.
Take our payment in jam.
System.
That is definitely not true, but they are in their 90s and my lease is like a 2-page document that's handwritten.
Right. Wow.
And they don't have a cell phone. I have to call them or an email address.
Turns out it's not legally binding at all.
Exactly. There's a lot of holes in this lease, but my rent started as... $2,250 a month.
No way.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, A, that's fascinating. B, in New York City, at least, I mean, you can't open a restaurant without partners.
Sure.
It's just prohibitively expensive these days.
Yeah.
But I mean, even at $2,250 a month, that's a decent amount of jam.
Exactly.
I mean, like when you started out, like, because you were selling, and now the jam sells for, what is retail for a jar of
I mean, it's still the same, pretty much. It's gone a dollar up, so it's between like $13 and $14, but it started at $12.
So it's good jam. Can people buy this online?
They can.
They can. Where should they go online to get it?
SquirrelLA.com.
Squirrel. How do you spell squirrel?
Incorrectly.
SquirrelLA. So there's two L's, kind mm-hmm. of, LA.com.
Yeah.
The jam, if you haven't had it, is worth it. And it's so not chunky. It's so smooth.
Right. Like,
how do you,
it's good.
How do you do that?
That's, I'm not going
to. You're not going to divulge the secrets?
Yeah, I want you to continue to be surprised. You know?
So it sort of luxuriates on the toast. Just
we just take,
hangs out.
I'll tell you this, we give it the time. Mm. So a lot of times we'll macerate overnight.
Right.
And that helps to pull in sugar and break down the fibers and give it the texture.
So you literally thought, I'm going to start a jam company? Like, that's a career?
Right? I don't know. And
you had a life before jam, though.
I did. I mean, I worked as a pastry chef in the South at a place called Bacchanalia.
In Atlanta. Fancy, high-end restaurant.
Yes. Yeah. And we did a lot of, you know, work in preservation. And so I think that idea of squirreling things away stemmed from...
Oh, that, I just got it.
Yeah. That's why it's called Squirrel. It's a girl who squirrels.
And you literally, at the time, did you have the notion that it could grow into a restaurant? Or were you like, I'm just going to do a sort of a jam confectionery sort of thing?
Yeah, I think it was more... you know, I'm so glad that sometimes I work with blinders on, that I just like go full force with what I'm passionate about and interested in. Because if I didn't, I think the fear of failure would have probably shattered the dream of starting a jam company. But you know, I think coming from a place in the South where, you know, they have such limited quantities of things, so it's so important to preserve, mm-hmm. whether it's charcuterie, pickles, protein, and coming to California where there was such a huge amount of those things, it really struck me that there was a discord. And so that's really what I wanted to do. I didn't know how it was going to work. And to be honest, I think the cafe stemmed out of that because it needed the support of a place where people came in every day, because I was hiding in those 1,000 square feet, like making jam, and I was sending them to Nancy Silverton's place, short order at the time. So, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah.
I needed to figure out how to.
Like financially, wasn't
it? Yeah. Yeah. That rent wasn't, it was hard to cover.
So, cover in jam. Mm-hmm.
Matt, could you, for the listener, put Squirrel into context in the restaurant world? Because a couple of years ago when you were working at BA,
sure.
you pitched this store and you were so passionate about this restaurant, Squirrel. And I was like, well, what's the why? Well, you want us to do a whole 8-page feature on this place in LA that serves breakfast and isn't even open for dinner. And
thank you.
Yeah. And I was just like, what?
Sure.
Why? I mean, what's so important about it?
There was this like sense that you were making breakfast happen. I mean, like, I think like before all the daytime cafes that have
crossed an interesting
like, avocado
breakfast.
Test and making it interesting. And it's like beyond oatmeal and even avocado toast. I think like there were clever things like your tabbouleh. I mean, your kale tabbouleh that you were doing. You weren't just serving toast. It was thick cut brioche that was kind of like burnt beyond where most people toast their toast, so it had like that really great crumb and texture, and you're slathering creamy ricotta to the very edges. It's not just like a dainty liberal whatever. It was fun, it was bright, it was in this part of town that people that I had never been to on my trips to LA. You know, I think I was like, you know, I was a West Side guy staying in Venice and Santa Monica. And then maybe a couple years later went downtown because that's where things were happening. And then even further east, there's Silver Lake or East Hollywood,
Let it be known that Matt's like a softie from the West Side, right? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Orange County, which is an hour south of where Jessica's
place is. Yeah, we've heard of it.
And Jessica also grew up in Orange County. So
I grew up in Long Beach.
But that's that's Orange County, right?
Los Angeles County.
Oh, is that Los Angeles County?
Just on the border.
I'm just trying
to be on the border.
Strong Beach, man. Come on. Matt. Don't try to pull her into the OC game.
Totally. That's true. Yeah, Snoop, I guess, did not grow up in Orange County.
No.
That totally makes sense. Yeah. But I just feel like when you walked into this place, like you come around the corner and there was a line the first time I went there. And I went there because Jeremy Fox, the chef in Los Angeles, who has Rustic Cannon and used to be up at Ubuntu in Napa and, you know, it's vegetable whisperer guy, was really psyched about what you were doing. And he was like, you got to go check this place out. There's a line. There's these brightly colored orange tables outside. There's a fun like blue painted wall at the little alcove outdoor at cafe. And then you walk in and it's this, at the time it was half the size of what it is now. Like, I don't think you had expanded further over. And it was just like this small little place where there were like a couple chefs working really hard on the line, an embarrassment of riches of pastries, like sitting on the counter and just kind of like handwritten menu on the wall. And I just think like there was something special. So I should point out that it wasn't just me that wanted this story to happen. Like the entire staff of
Bon Appetit. Except for me. I was the last guy. I was like, oh, okay.
Still hasn't been there, but it's okay.
I think for breakfast and lunch, we're used to not, you know, at dinner time, maybe you're used to maybe splitting more. And a lot of times at breakfast, you want your one dish. But in this case, you each get different dishes, so you share them. So I like to think of each dish as a meal, and therefore it should be hearty enough to be satisfying.
Yeah, and let's talk about, Matt mentioned your kabuli, which seems to be one of the favorite on the menu. And my wife is now obsessed with that dish, and we make it frequently. It's not an easy dish to make. Can you explain how this dish came about?
The kabuli came about because I do love tabbouleh, right? But there's couscous in it, which has gluten. And typically there's tomatoes, which are not always in season.
No.
So trying to figure out an alternative for those months where there aren't tomatoes kind of was the reason for the kabuli. We have crispy rice on the menu, which is our brown rice, which is laid on sheet trays and dried.
Because this is like the key move. So explain this. So you make brown rice in a pot. Mm-hmm. And you spread it on a sheet tray,
Then and we let it dry overnight.
So if you're baking this at home, you got to start a day ahead.
Yeah, and here's the thing too: is there are alternatives again, which I think goes back to what Squirrel is about, in the cookbook too, is that there are alternatives for all of this. So if you don't want to wait overnight and dry out the rice and then fry it the next day, you can cook quinoa and dehydrate that, and it's crunchy. So it adds.
How do you dehydrate it?
In the oven.
Right.
Literally,
okay.
It takes 15 minutes. Like,
well, you make it sound so fancy when you say dehydrate.
I know.
You say put it in the oven.
Look,
your 90-year-old landlords, they know how to put stuff in the oven. I don't know if they know how to dehydrate.
Yeah. Well, pulling the moisture out. All right. So we do use a dehydrator, but not for quinoa.
But you're a professional.
I will say that the first time I made the kabuli at home, you know, we got the recipe and was like, oh, God, this is going to take me a day. There's nothing like that kind of fried crispy rice. It's so cool, and it's a perfect example of something that's worth the time.
It's one of these transcendent dishes. So I remember hearing about this. Is it worth it? So you dehydrate it overnight. So you've got these cool crispy rice bits, and then you toss that with
currants that have been reconstituted with red wine vin, and then that reconstituted liquid is used for a dressing, and it has the currants in it with Aleppo and sumac, cauliflower, and chopped kale.
And you sort of like shave, like disintegrate a cauliflower into little bits, so it blends with the kale, which is kind of in the place of the herbs that you get in tabbouleh.
Exactly. And the currants are kind of in the place of
the tomatoes.
And we in winter,
this all makes sense now.
In winter, we can add pomegranates because that's so awesome. And in summer, we could potentially take the currants out and add tomatoes back in. So just kind of those little things. But I think the thing for the food at Squirrel, yes, there are things that are heavy like the ricotta toast, but my palate tends to gear like lighter and brighter. Mm-hmm. And so the question always comes, how do you make a dish that's vibrant and bright yet still feels satisfying? And part of it can be adding that crispy rice because it adds a little bit of that. Like,
well, it's funny because like there's a crispiness, which is like, oh, this is a little bit bad for me. But then there's like the kale and the raw cauliflower and all everything else. Like, no, this is good for me.
I think like that dish gets people excited about breakfast in a way that I just don't think people have been excited about breakfast in a long time. I mean, some people are breakfast people and like all they needed, like Adam Rappaport right here, all he needs is like a perfect fried egg or, you know, and like that gets him going. But I think like you get 20 people sitting outside ordering like five dishes for two people at your restaurant. And I think like that is because it's something that people haven't tried before.
Yeah. It's maybe like the FOMO feeling, you know, like, and that happens a lot where, you know, people coming in, they're from out of town, they don't know when they're going to come back, and we don't have Eggs Benedict, you know, and we have things like sorrel rice and like a golden beet soca pancake with horseradish labneh, and like, where else are you going to find these things?
But it's weirdly satisfying in a way that, yes, French toast or Eggs Benedict is, but it's satisfying in a way that you don't know or don't expect it. You're kind of, seems like you're surprised.
Right.
Those, the pancakes we have in the magazine, we shot that pancake and they're all crispy and it's just beautiful.
It's like a latke,
but I've
basically.
never seen that before. One thing Matt and I were talking about was breakfast culture. And I was arguing that LA is kind of uniquely suited to breakfast culture in a way that New York is not, because there's so many people in LA who don't work conventional day jobs. They're in this business or that business, and they work on projects, but there's like, oh, it's Tuesday morning, you're going to meet a friend for breakfast at 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
In New York, you're at work at 9:30.
What do you think, Matt?
That's what I thought I was saying, like, Rappo was like, well, what was it like? I was like, well, I think it like made LA into like kind of a breakfast town. I think like there's a lot more places. You look at Giusta in Venice, that is like, you know, this kind of all day breakfast.
Dude, that's like, but that is Venice. Like no one works in that. I go to like, you go to Intelligentsia in Venice at like 3:30 p.m. Like who are all these people just hanging out?
So
like,
maybe
good looking guys with beards and like gals in tank tops and like who, what
and
is
Jake
going on
Gyllenhaal
here? And Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't know. I those people might have been in place to go order breakfast, but I don't think there was like a real breakfast culture 5 years ago besides like going to Shutters or something and meeting for a breakfast like at the
power
hotel or
whatever,
power breakfasting.
Yeah. Interesting. So there's power breakfast, but not hipster breakfast.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I worked in Melbourne for a time where the breakfast culture, coffee culture is really
huge
strong.
There. Yeah.
And I think coming from a place like that where brekkie is taken very seriously.
Just did the air quotes.
I know. I did the air quotes for brekkie.
That's what they call it. You know?
Where it is taken seriously and it's unique. And I came back to the States and I did also feel that disconnect of like, all right, why is everyone playing so safe? And I've had this conversation where I have some fine dining chefs that are friends of mine and they're like, man, good on you. Breakfast is a hard game. Breakfast and lunch, hard game. No one's drinking alcohol. That's how people, restaurants stay open and make their money.
That's your profit margin.
That is your profit margin. And it's true. So what do we have to do? We have to make a place that's unique and exciting that people are willing to come and wait in line.
Yeah.
And, you know, our service isn't 4 hours, it's 8 hours. And so that I think that's the difference. But in LA, we do have a creative culture. We have a lot more people that are freelance.
What is it like to kind of like grow a project organically like you have? I mean, like you didn't start out knowing it was going to be what it is today. And I think like a lot of restaurants grow and evolve and like, you know, it's not fair to review a restaurant in the first 6 months because it's going to change so much. But I think few restaurants change as like dramatically as yours has, like in terms of scope and ambition. Is that exciting as you're going along, or is that like flying by the seat of your pants a little bit, or is that just kind of how it happened and you wouldn't do it again? Or I mean, you know, just like it's been interesting to watch, but I wonder what it's like from your perspective.
I was so lucky because no one really knew who I was or what I was doing.
There's no expectations.
And there was no friends and family opening. The doors just opened. And so it has allowed me to evolve. And the thing is that I've slowly taken over the rest of the building, and that's how I've been able to evolve. That space as 1,000 square feet is not able to operate efficiently and to serve the kind of quality of food and the type of experience that I wanted. So yeah, it's just been lucky in happenstance that the building itself has allowed me to grow. So now instead of 1,000 square feet, I have 6,000.
Wow. I think that gradual growth is so essential. It's interesting. You look at so many restaurants now and the amount of money that's invested and the pressure and the press coverage before it opens. It's not a knock against Eater, but it's what Eater does. But month by month, there will be updates. If you're a big name chef, how the project's coming along. When I was in LA last time, a couple of years ago, not going to Squirrel, I got taken to that restaurant, Republic? Mm-hmm. How do I pronounce that?
Republic.
Yeah.
I mean, just like the amount of money they must have spent.
The grandness.
Yeah, of that restaurant. And, you know, it was packed and good for them. And that was Nancy's old restaurant, right?
Mm-hmm.
That
was
Campanile.
Most of the grandness was in place, luckily, for them. They didn't do that much, actually, that space.
No, but that space needed work.
Yeah, right.
I mean, they modernized it
a lot.
You know?
And the open kitchen, everything, when you walk in and the wood fire and all that stuff. But, it's like, and then you've just dropped $1 million or however much on a restaurant, and then you're like, wow, you better start killing it right away.
$1 million, that's not even a lot.
Yes.
And I think, I mean, something to say here is that I'm actually doing a project where I've swung the opposite way, where I do have a partner on something else I'm doing. And
what town?
Los Angeles.
Okay.
Yeah. Closer to where you typically stay.
Yeah.
And so now it's concerning, you know, like, what do I do? Because I really liked the development and involvement of what Squirrel was. And I don't necessarily enjoy the press
and now it's the restaurant from
PR.
The Squirrel person.
Yeah. Like,
I mean, that's a ton of pressure, and you're going to get written about every 5 minutes.
And you have destroyed.
Yeah.
And,
they like to take you down. But yeah, I mean, you have this quote in the new issue of Cherry Bomb, which they pull quoted.
Yeah.
I kind of love. I was so hot last year. How do you stay fucking hot? And like, that's true. It's like, do you feel that pressure now?
Yeah, of course. I think for me, and again, like, because I kind of work with these blinders, it's very helpful because there's something opening all the time. Eater is always talking about what's opening. And the question is always to me, like, how do I stay true to myself and continue to evolve and continue to grow and make things unique in a landscape which kind of is begging chefs in some respect to kind of like take a deal, open up more and more and more places because it, you know, the truth is that one restaurant doesn't make you a lot of money, but three or four or five or six will.
But now you're beholden to a partner. And that person, whoever this person is,
she's amazing.
Yeah, who I imagine is investing a fair amount of money to open a place. And so then you've got to make money off the bat.
Yeah, so, yeah.
She's really stressing her out.
Heart palpitations.
Look, and the thing too is like,
are you sure you don't want to rethink this?
Yeah. It took me a long time to, I mean, she and I worked out what we're doing for the last, 8 months. And like any other chef, I've been given a lot of opportunities, and this one was the right one. So Squirrel Away will open this year. It's the rest of the building. And then doing a book is
what's your book next year?
October.
Oh, this October. That's right. I know it's October. This is October 16.
Yes, October 16. Yeah. It was almost like opening a restaurant to do a book.
Who did you write with someone?
I did. Her name's Maria Ziska. Okay. She did Camino and AOC, and she's working on Liz Pruitt from Tartine's new book.
Mm-hmm. Love Liz. How was the experience for you?
That was the experience all in has been really empowering. Mm-hmm. I think because I don't do anything half-assed. So I guess the backstory is that Squirrel, I have a friend named Scott. And Scott and I started Squirrel together. So he does all the design elements, like the website, the jars, posters, whatever. And I do the food and operations. And so he, you know, Squirrel is partly his baby, and he's also my creative director for the new project. So he and I did the book together.
Okay. So he handled the design elements of the book?
Exactly. So the thing is that Abrams, who's the publisher, didn't touch any of the book. Like,
that's awesome.
We did the fonts, we did the layout, all the photography came through us. We have three photographers that did the photos. So it was a production that he and I did together from page one to page 280. And it, you know, every choice from like the paper stock to whether it's auto bound, the texture of the paper, the jacket, all those things were really micromanaged to a level of hopefully you guys will really like this.
Yeah.
We're really proud of it.
The fact that you were able to do that is awesome.
Did you learn something about you and your food when you're having to go through this creative process to write the book? Did it illuminate anything that you maybe didn't see before? Or
yeah, I mean, a lot of the recipes are amazing and wonderful, and I'm glad they're there. And of course, there are some where I'm like, oh man, I should have photographed this differently or tinkered with this differently, or I have recipes now that I would have loved to have included in there.
That's the next book.
Sure. I'm looking at the Bon Appetit magazine right now, and there's a recipe or a photo of a dish that's no longer at the restaurant, and that was a classic at the time, but I have pulled it, and I wouldn't have thought to even put it in the book because we've evolved.
It's like that friend you broke up with.
Yeah.
Like, we're not friends anymore.
No. We're only on Facebook.
But it's interesting. You mentioned How to Cook Everything, and that suggests a cookbook that people would use and something that you,
doesn't just
you
sit
cook
on
with.
Coffee table.
But that's different, though. But you also mentioned Kinch's book and Manresa, and that is much more of an heirloom book about a Michelin-starred restaurant, mm-hmm. and it's big and it's beautiful, and it's more of a piece that you'd be proud of 20 years from now, but that's different than a book that people use.
Sure.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, a book, Brooke Headley's pastry book, to me is one of the best books of the last 10 years. One reason is that, I mean, his viewpoint is just so unique.
Well,
his voice is so powerful that you really know that it's Brooks when you read that. Now, the recipes, some are really challenging, and I think the book is the same way, is that, you know, you look at a book like Jelena and it's very friendly and it's very accessible, and so people really love it. I look at my book and I know, I see the voice is so clear, and yet some of the recipes, I get the call from Holly at Abrams being like, man, some of these recipes are really challenging. Like, you have some more accessible ones, right? And the point is to make a book where it's maybe more like Jerusalem, where there are a lot of ingredients, and, or you can choose the step you want to make. You don't have to make
Jerusalem
all these...
the Ottolenghi book, not Jerusalem the city.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, part of what's so exciting about Squirrel is that modifications are politely accepted. You know, and you're going to restaurants where it's politely declined a lot, and
yeah, or not politely,
or not honestly. Sure. Yeah. And so the book itself has to have that same kind of ethos where you can modify by doing this or that, or you don't have, you know, like you don't have to smoke trout if you don't want to. Like Trader Joe's has amazing tins.
But do you make that point to the reader? So you let them know that.
Yes.
Okay. See, I think that's always important as an editor. Always give people options.
Make it okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all right to take the shortcut and it can still be a delicious dish. Mm-hmm. All right, so Jesse, you've obviously got a lot to do. You got a business to run. You got a new restaurant to open. You got a cookbook to get done. But it's before you go, we have to do the lightning round.
Oh. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Christy Yamaguchi or Nancy Kerrigan? And why are we asking that question?
I grew up as a figure skater, so that's why you're asking.
Did you know that, Ducker?
I did not know that.
Wow.
Yeah. Christy Yamaguchi.
Oh, why?
Just so classy. Just so graceful and classy.
All right. Turmeric tonic? Or gin and tonic?
Turmeric tonic.
Come on.
Turmeric tonic.
With gin.
Or gin martini. Oh, okay. That's another question.
Poached or fried?
Depends.
You get whoa. One. You get one for the rest of your life.
Fried. Fried the right way.
Fried in what?
Fried the right way. Which is what?
Butter.
And butter. Okay.
Yeah, but like fried
crisp.
Baked. No.
Wait,
no
fried
brown.
Baked? What does that mean?
It means like you get it on the stove and going, and then you transfer it into the oven.
Wow.
So the white's set.
So white set, you don't have brown anywhere.
Yeah. This guy likes a crispy.
I'm an olive oil guy, but I never knew this. What temperature do you put in the oven?
350.
And for how long?
I mean, you literally keep it on the stove until you start to see the white set, and then you pop it into the oven.
And in the oven about?
A minute.
All right, sorrel pesto or pesto?
Sorrel pesto.
There's nothing better than basil pesto.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Look,
like there really is nothing better. Come
it
on.
Just depends.
Wait till
it
you have sorrel pesto wrapper. You're gonna love this.
Depends on the season.
East side or west side?
East side. And west side.
Wait, oh, come
whoa.
On. Don't try to
she doesn't want to alienate her customers on the west side of Los Angeles to travel an hour to come have
and then
breakfast.
Wait in line for half an hour.
West side feels like vacation, east side feels like home.
Hazelnut butter or almond butter?
Almond butter. I mean, our nut butter, you know that our nut butter at Squirrel is almond and hazelnut.
Oh.
Savory or sweet?
I grew up eating like bags of Sour Patch Kids.
Mm. So you just answered the question.
Yeah. An ice cream is my desert island food. So I guess that's the answer.
Okay. Succulents or flowers?
Flowers.
Yeah.
They're a lot more expensive though. Succulents kind of last forever, right? You just put them in the window of your
it's
little
true,
hipster
so,
healthy cafe and like they're there. recipe development or working the line?
You know what? Recipe development. And I'd like to expand on this.
Yeah, sure.
Because my chefs really enjoy the recipe development of the day-to-day. Like, oh, I'm making a special. It's going to go on today. Like, yes. I really like the recipe development of dish, like, of staples. And I think that that's something that... a lot of chefs are like, ugh, like I want to keep evolving. And I do too, but I like to create things that have lasting impact, like a sorrel pesto or like the new chicken porridge.
No, that's, like I said, they a good idea lasts forever.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, Matt, a couple more.
All right. Lacto-fermented hot sauce or Cholula?
Lacto-fermented hot sauce. I'm not even thinking twice about that.
Real.
God, I mean, so confident. I love, but I do love Cholula.
I love Cholula.
Right now,
it's so good.
Guys.
It's so good. All right, last question. Olive oil or butter?
You know, I love using butter. Mm. I also love using olive oil with butter when you're doing proteins.
Yeah.
To get a sear. Mm. A
little
good sear.
Little depth.
But, yeah.
So that's kind of a punt. You're punting on that one. You got to choose one.
I use butter.
Okay, all right, butter. Yeah. Proudly,
I can't believe I use butter.
I can't believe it's butter. All right, Jessica Kozlov, Matt Ducker. Thanks, guys. All right, that was Jessica Kozlov with Matt Ducker and me. Coming up next, we head to Las Vegas, where Andrew Knowlton and I talked summer drinking with Bon Appetit wine columnist Marissa A. Ross. And one thing, if the sound is not as smooth and buttery as you're used to, that's because we recorded this segment in a suite in the Nobu Tower at Caesar's Palace. So not ideal audio conditions, but we had a good talk anyways. Hope you dig it. All right, so Marissa, last summer I wrote a piece for the .com about how I was over rosé. That we had hit peak rosé and I just couldn't bring myself to buy another bottle last summer. Fair or unfair assessment?
Absolutely fair. I felt the exact same way after last summer. I think the last summer was very much like rosé season. It like hit the fucking main... Excuse me.
Yeah, you can say that.
Am I allowed to cuss?
Yes, yes.
All right, well, it hit the fucking mainstream and it was... overload. It was way, way too much rosé. I felt the exact same. In fact, at the end of last summer, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to drink rosé ever again. I was so done with it, with the culture around it, and everything. It was too much. But
it's not like you got tired of drinking rosé. Was it because everybody else was drinking rosé?
I would say twofold to that. A, I did get tired of drinking rosé, but in April, when it finally started to get nice in New York, the first thing I did on the first nice day of spring was run to the wine store and buy a bottle of rosé. So
it wasn't like a band thing where it's like, oh, everyone's listening to my favorite band, so I can't listen to it now.
Right.
It was that everyone was drinking rosé all the time without any sort of variation. And that's boring and just too much. Like the amount of rosé that people wanted to consume on a regular basis was way too much.
Yeah. I think there was a little palate fatigue. Is that a phrase?
Yes.
Can I say that?
I think that we should start using that more often.
Right. Yeah.
But I will say a Côte de Provence rosé, I will happily drink any day of the week.
I will happily drink it if I'm in Provence, especially.
Well,
yeah. But it's fascinating. I don't have, you know, numbers in front of me, but from a marketing perspective, I thought you would walk into a wine store and there would just now be a wall of rosé as soon as you walked in, and every hue and shade of pink to peach and whatnot to strawberry. And it's kind of amazing. The sales of rosé worldwide, or at least in America, of worldwide rosé is must just skyrocketed.
No, it skyrocketed, and it was just fascinating to see brands that normally didn't do rosés jumping on the rosé bandwagon and producing some inferior stuff that was not even like the correct production.
And that's the problem too, is it's people just now also just producing rosé because it is a thing.
Yeah.
And as someone that lives in California, I had no idea what rosé season was. And then I went to New York in March where everyone was like, well, aren't you so excited rosé season is coming? And I'm like, wait, I didn't know that there was a season for it because I drink it all the time.
Like I said, I kind of hit that peak rosé last summer, and I said I had to make a point. It's not easy to not drink rosé because it's served everywhere. It's at every party, every menu. But I'm like, I'm going to make a point to not drink it. And my question to you is, Knowlton and Marissa, if you're not drinking rosé this summer, but you want that affordable, crisp, easy-to-drink bottle of wine, what are you drinking?
Well, if the same thing's happening with a red wine that I love, and I think Marissa likes it too, is the Gamay, the Beaujolais boom.
Yeah.
Beaujolais Village. And I've been drinking that for a couple years, you know, once more of these bottles beyond the Georges de Boeuf Beaujolais Nouveau came. So these are like really light, low octane wines. Really, I mean,
we're talking red.
If you close your eyes, you wouldn't even know that you were drinking a red. It would feel like a white almost.
Yeah, and what's interesting too about the whole Gamay movement right now, which Gamay has been my favorite grape for a really long time. I love it because it does sort of mimic white wine and rosé in a lot of ways in terms of drinkability. But you go to, you know, AOC in LA, and they're like, oh, can we throw your Morgana on ice for a little while? And I'm like, wow, it's incredible that
they know.
That they know. Like, everyone kind of knows.
Do they know?
They know that you can throw a Gamay on ice, and it's delicious. And it's as refreshing, I think, as a white wine.
The question to you is, if you're not drinking a rosé on ice, what is a comparable wine that you're going to drink?
Muscadet. All the time. Yeah. I drink that. If I'm having oysters or shellfish or grilling out, I think it's a perfect wine. A Pique Poule, which is a French...
Pique Poule is a great and a kind of a lesser-known wine that's really, really awesome and very like Sauvignon Blanc, but I think a little more complex.
A little bit more flavor, but...
And a Muscadet is an affordable white French wine, easy to find. What region is it from?
Mostly Brittany, though. I mean, it's kind of match made in heaven with briny
oysters and stuff.
Yeah.
And they're affordable. They're super affordable. Just like peak pools are.
Yeah, peak pools are great. I'm always going to say Vino Verde and like Chenin Blanc is like what I would drink instead of. I mean, Chenin's just go with everything.
It's funny that Chenin Blanc, something that was so kind of naughty to drink Chenin Blanc, it was like the housewife, you know, or the, and now it's kind of coming back.
Explain that reference. Well,
to me. I think when Chenin Blanc became. I don't want to say it was like the Chardonnay before Chardonnay became Chardonnay, but it was
yeah,
like,
I wouldn't go as far as that.
It was like ladies who lunch would drink, I'll have a Chenin Blanc, you know? Yeah. And I actually think they made like wine coolers out of shitty Chenin Blanc.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And so it got this reputation, but there's some of the most amazing French wines are made from the Chenin Blanc grape.
Well, and now too, I think with the whole like low intervention movement that's happening, I think that Chenin Blanc is really getting reinvented through that, where they're a lot crisper, tartar, brighter than some of the Chenin Blancs of yesteryear.
Talking about like wine coolers and stuff, I will basically spritz up any cocktail. I will put club soda on anything and ice. I think it makes it better. But I've actually never had a wine spritzer.
I have some in my room. I could have brought them.
Really?
I have them in a can.
But like, what do you ever spritz up wine?
Yes.
Like, and if so, what kind?
No, I don't. If I'm gonna spritz something up, I'm having a liquor.
As someone that
you're gonna spritz up some gin.
Yeah.
As someone that drinks during the day often while writing, it's very beneficial for me to spritz things up. And those light reds are great for spritzing.
So yeah, all right. So you can spritz up a red.
Oh yeah, like Gamay. I mean, Gamay is just like an all-around grape, but you could do it with like any of those lighter French reds. Like you could do it with like Grulot or any of those.
And now,
like
will you put them in ice in the glass?
I usually do. Well, and to be totally honest, I usually spritz up wines that I don't like so much. Like if I get a bottle of something that I'm very iffy about, I'll add, you know, half a can of LaCroix and throw some ice on it and then like mash up whatever fruit is in my fridge.
I was going to say, you basically take, you know, a red that you're not crazy about, or something that's not, that you didn't spend, you know, $25 on, spritz it up, add, you know, you're basically making sangria or some sort of gin and tonic, and you're putting all those kind of botanicals in there and orange slices. You can put anything and make, you know, it's kind of refreshing.
You always want to do, you always want to do like citrus. Like everything should always have like a little bit. I always do lemon or lime, whether I'm doing red or white.
Really?
Yeah, always add
like
a little
bit. I feel like I've not introduced this at all. Club soda and then some, what'd you say? What
lemon,
else?
Lime, and then orange, like strawberries, cantaloupe.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you know something I do, which is getting into more sangria territory, I will even hit a little sherry in there make it with a red, just to make it even more cocktail like.
Wow. If you're making sangria though, sangria is typically sweetened, correct, in some manner?
Typically you add sugar to it.
Yeah.
Like I remember, do you ever go to Rio Mar, Knowlton, when it was open in the West Village and in the Meatpacking District, back when there were actual meatpacking in the Meatpacking District, and there was this great old Spanish bar / restaurant. And the sangrias there were great, and I actually watched them one time make it. And it was basically like a whole, like one of those handles of big jug
Pepe
reds.
Pepe Rosa.
Yeah. And then like, it was like that and a bottle of Sprite. And like, I mean, or maybe it was like some triple sec. I mean, it was insane like what went in there. I was like, oh my God.
But it's funny to watch people who even say they don't like sangria, when it's like sangria, they don't have to order and it's just presented at a party. People love sangria.
They love it.
Yeah.
And
I like the notion of a white sangria.
Well, I was just about to say is that in like probably the last 2 years, I've seen like a big boom in white sangria in terms of like it being at parties, but also in restaurants in LA are very big on white sangria right now. And it's great. It's just a little bit more refreshing, I think, than red sangria.
Well, you have some sparkling wine here.
I do. Yeah.
What do you got?
It's coming to temperature.
I think it's a good temperature now. So I have the Ultramarine Sparkling Pinot Noir from Sonoma. It's made by Michael Cruz.
When I go to weddings now, and it's like, well, you go to one of those July, August weddings where cocktail hour, the sun is still like beating down on your head and you're like getting sunburned and stuff, I will just ask for a big goblet full of ice and then just full of Prosecco.
You need to get over your guilt that you feel you can do whatever you want with ice.
No, but I'm not feeling guilty. I'm saying everyone should do
this. Oh, but you're always apologizing for your use of ice in beer or cocktails.
Well, you put ice in beer?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I'm proselytizing because like on a hot wedding afternoon, like you're walking around with some champagne or Prosecco and it's going to be warm like in four minutes.
I couldn't agree with you more.
I think that the stigma around, you know, ice and wine just needs to go.
Yeah,
I just think that if that's how you enjoy something, just enjoy it, and to hell with anyone that wants to.
I also think that this is a different topic, but I just think that Americans are finally drink what you want to drink and how you want to drink it. If you want vodka, drink vodka. If you want a oaky Chardonnay that nobody in their right mind should be drinking, drink it. You know, like, who cares? The French do that all the time.
Just don't force it on someone else. I have a friend who I'm not going to name, but we were visiting her last summer on Shelter Island in New York, and she literally only drinks Pimm's cups, which
I respect
is
that.
Usually Pimm's and either like ginger ale or Sprite or whatever, and
then cucumber and strawberries stuff in there. Yeah,
so that if she like she came to our house for a barbecue, she literally brought her own bottle of Pimm's.
I like
that's
that.
Great. I think that that's so smart because there's so many people that I mean, it's weird because I get people that ask me about that, like, well, what do you do if like you're somewhere? Bring your own. Yeah. Like, if you really have something that you love and you...
If you think your shit's better than that.
Yeah, just bring your... I mean, I bring my own stuff everywhere. I brought my own stuff today.
Yeah, so
I
what are we drinking? What do we got?
So today I brought us the Ultramarine Pinot Noir Rosé. It's from Sonoma Coast. Oh. And it's made by Michael Cruz, who is a really, really awesome winemaker out of California.
He's and spell Petaluma. His last name so people...
C-R-U-S-E. And yes. He has a Cruz Wine Company. This is different. Ultramarine is its own thing. But all of his wines, I think, are just extremely well-crafted and special. And particularly these sparkling wines are one of the harder ones of his to get. But it's what he's making his name off of. Like, he's really bringing a lot of artisanship back to California sparkling wine.
You have to uncork it in the microphone so we hear it pop.
Should I do that now?
Yeah, go ahead. Wow! Good God! Oh, my God.
It's a sparkling rosé. Correct.
So these Cruz wines, I will say, they've started to pop up on the East Coast.
Okay.
There's a lot of them. It's a name to look for, and if see it on a wine list, get it because it's only going to go up in price.
Making California cool.
When I came into the office in December, I brought in that Saint Laurent that I couldn't believe that I saw in New York.
Oh, when you said Saint Laurent, I thought you were joking and making fun of me for like in the Saint Laurent fashion label.
No,
you were literally there's actually a wine called Saint Laurent.
No, there's a grape varietal called Saint Laurent. It used to be extremely prominent in California, and then they basically ripped it all out to make room for Cabernet. And so now it's one of the California varietals that a lot of smaller wineries are bringing back. It's awesome. It's a really light, nice grape.
So enjoy. I just tasted this Ultramarine Pinot Noir Rosé Sparkler. It seems like this would be a good food wine. Is that fair to say? Got some body to it.
It's got some. It's rich. It's got a richness to it, but it's got some crazy acidity too.
I'm so excited to try this right now. I've been saving this. I've had this for a while.
You know, I love drinking champagne with any food.
Me too. Absolutely.
Whether it's pizza or foie gras.
Champagne goes with everything.
Yes. This wine in particular, the Cruz, or not the Cruz, but
The Ultramarine. Yeah.
The Ultramarine. I think it would be amazing with sushi.
Oh yeah, 100%. I think that rosé and sushi is like my favorite in terms of wine with sushi.
Thanks for joining us today. Go drink some summer wine.
Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mooj Zaidi and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday. And if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.